Every moment of every day, there's so much that competes for our attention, isn't there? Oh, excuse me a second. No, I'm actually in the middle of worship. Sorry, I can't talk right now. Sorry about that. Oh, anyway, so as I was saying, there's a lot that competes for our attention these days, isn't there? Oh my gosh, look, there's a little baby squirrel out there. No, seriously, there is. Look at it. Oh, now it's gone. Never mind. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying. Wait, do you hear that funny noise on the freeway out there? I think it must be a truck or something. Oh, well, never mind. So does your brain ever do anything like this? Jumping rapidly from one thought to another? No, Michael, that's good. Like, what shall I have for lunch today? Or, look how beautiful those trees are behind the altar. Maybe I should hike that mountain sometime. Or I hope she gets done quickly so that I can go home and watch football. Or, oh, my stomach's rumbling. I forgot to eat breakfast, I think. Oh, well, hopefully they'll have some good snacks over there. Anyone? Yes, Carol? And those are just some of the things competing for our attention in our heads right now, am I right? Unfortunately, there's a lot more than our thoughts contending for our attention these days. According to the marketing site Lookbook HQ, every minute there are over 200 million new emails, 16 million text messages, and 350,000 tweets sent every minute. And every 60 seconds, 87,000 hours of video are streamed by Netflix subscribers. Can you imagine? The list goes on, amounting to streams of content and communication that cause us to unlock our smartphones around 100 times a day. And believe it or not, many youngsters these days do their homework on their computer while they watch something else on their phones, while they're talking to their friends online. Believe me, I see it every day. And personally, I don't understand how they get anything done. But their brains now seem to crave this continuous multitasking of looking at their phones while they're doing other things. And just focusing on one thing at a time seems to be rather dull or has definitely gone out of vogue these days. Have you ever seen groups of people going out to dinner together, and often you'll see everyone looking out their phones and not talking or interacting with each other? And I'm thinking, why even bother go out to dinner with each other? And this constant distraction is not only changing the physiology of our brains, but it's also affecting the quality of our relationships and our ability to pay attention. Oh, and then, of course, there's the daily assault on our senses from all the news flashing on our screens, so many frightening headlines and images grabbing our attention. And that's not even mentioning all the daily demands of living and working and our families that require attention. And then there are the somewhat alluring distractions that may provide short-term satisfaction, but that don't truly nourish or fortify our hearts and souls. I'm thinking about spending hours on Facebook, or binge-watching endless episodes of Netflix, or playing video games. Anyone? Now, these can be fun, of course, no doubt, but when added to all the other demands of life, they can also suck up any last ounce of attention that we have left and leave our souls, which crave attention, feeling empty. When we let our attention ricochet from one stimulus to the next, those energies, that information, those distractions literally impact our brain formation, scientists have now found. In fact, what we focus on actually changes the physiology of our brains. I was speaking with a friend in Northern California this week who had her power shut off 36 hours last weekend. And she lives alone in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Now, she said it was difficult at first because all the ways that she usually spends her time were cut off. No internet, no Facebook, No electricity to charge her phone, no TV. No hum of the refrigerator to keep her quietly company. Just her and the beautiful woods outside her home. And it reminded her that most of humanity lived without electricity for centuries. Actually, she remarked, it gave her the space to slow down and do things that nourished her being. She read a book. She sat beneath the towering redwood trees outside on her porch, and she listened to the birds singing. She painted, she knitted, she meditated and went for long walks. And if she hadn't been living alone, she mused, she might have had long conversations with her friends or family. The philosopher and writer Pico Iyer agrees, in an age of acceleration, he says, nothing can be more exhilarating than going slow. In an age of distraction, nothing is so luxurious as paying attention. In an age of constant movement, nothing is so urgent as sitting still, which you all are getting the chance to do for an hour right now. But with all of these distractions so widely and easily available, kind of like junk food, we have to actually make a conscious decision to shift our attention elsewhere. To shift our attention to something that truly nourishes us. Offering our attention is tantamount to offering our love. Right? Because where we pay attention reaps rewards. Like our children, our partners, our work, plants, animals, all benefit from being watered by our attention. Focusing on areas that matter can help us sustain life on Earth rather than contribute to its dissolution. But we have to intentionally choose to become mindful. Choose not to be hijacked by our distractions. Choose what we want to pay attention to, and choose what we feed our mind and body. As one of my favorite authors, Charles Eisenstein, says, we are what we eat, and any object of our attention becomes a kind of food. Any object of our attention becomes a kind of food. So think of what happens to us when we eat junk food. If we feed ourselves a diet of pizza, donuts, and soda, though perhaps comforting in the short term and very delicious, our bodies will soon start to feel its effects. Now, in the moment, it may feel like comfort food because it's a familiar, yummy treat. But after a while, giving our repeated attention to something so harmful to us can actually make us sick. And likewise, if we allow ourselves to be continually inundated by negativity, by criticism, by competition and fear, by a lot of the climate that we're living in these days, our brains and hearts will contract. We're generally going to feel more anxious, more depressed, and empty inside, and will be less available for life-sustaining, generous, and kind thinking. And we'll be less present to help this world move into a positive direction. Boy, do we need that now, don't we? In short, my friends, where we pay attention matters. It matters to our brains and bodies, not to mention our own sanity and happiness. It matters to those around us. It matters because paying attention is a way of showing love. And it matters for the kind of world we want to create. So it's of utmost importance, especially if we wish to develop resilience within, or habits that help us deal with anxiety, depression, stress, high blood pressure, and so forth. It's easy to be swept away by the river of competing demands, so we have to be intentional about where we place our attention. The New York Times best-selling author and psychologist Rick Hansen explains in his latest book, Hardwiring Happiness, that your experiences of happiness, worry, love, and anxiety can make real changes in your neural networks. What you pay attention to, what you rest your mind upon, is the primary shaper of your brain, according to experience-dependent neuroplasticity, which is where mindfulness practice comes in. Mindfulness practice reshapes our brains by teaching us how to pay attention and how to exercise our choice in where we pay attention. Daniel Goleman, author of the best-selling book Emotional Intelligence, now has a new book called Focus. And he actually wants to relabel meditation attention practice. And he'd like to make attention practice a required part of every school curriculum. Don't you think that would be great? And every government. In fact, in the English Parliament, they have brought in mindfulness practice, despite it looking very different. But they are doing mindfulness practice. So mindfulness or attention training helps us become aware of our habitual thinking and thereby gives us the freedom to choose where we put our attention. In fact, according to Goleman, it turns out that the ability to pay attention is one of the greatest predictors of job and life success. The more we can become aware of our thoughts, the more we can begin to exercise some choice over whether they'll nourish or damage us. Jon Kabat-Zinn, whom I'm sure many of you know, he created the Stress Reduction Clinic and the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. And he's helped thousands of people heal through his mindfulness-based stress reduction program. Has anyone here done that? Yeah, Jake, me too. It's a great program, and I encourage any of you who are curious to look it up. He suggests that when we meditate, we should imagine our minds like a waterfall. Thoughts are constantly going to be cascading down the waterfall. And either we can ride them through the turbulence and let one thought after the next cascade through our mind, or we can choose to sit on a comfortable rock at the top of the waterfall, at the edge of the cascade, and we can observe all the thoughts rushing by and enjoy the sound of the rushing water, but not get swept up and away by it. Isn't that a wonderful metaphor? But why is it actually important to be conscious of our thoughts and watch them? Does it really matter to do that? I think it matters greatly because we create our internal and external reality, our relationships, our work, and our health by what we pay attention to. It's our choice. We can give attention to the negative, to what's wrong in our lives and with others, to pain, to stressful thoughts, and to unhappiness, or we can consciously pivot to focus on what's good, what nourishes us, taking in the richness of life and the beauty all around. We can focus on the good we can do in a situation, on the healing or the justice or compassion we can bring. It's our choice, and our lives will be deeply impacted by that choice every moment and every day, and I really can attest to that. Recently, I met a woman who consciously made such a choice. Let's call her Pat. Now, Pat was covered in tattoos from head to toe, and she had a robust, strong body. And her face was kind, but her appearance a little bit intimidating when you first saw her. And as we got into conversation, she told me that she'd been a drug addict and that she was often depressed and angry with life. She'd had a difficult childhood, various health problems, and a painful, abusive relationship. And she felt herself going down a negative spiral and fearing where she was going to end up. And then one day, Pat talked with a friend who told her about their rewarding career in massage therapy. Curious, Pat decided to explore it as a possible career for herself. And as she investigated it, she realized that when she gave massage to others, she found herself focused on kindness and tenderness. Her intuition was awakened, and her depression and her anger began to lift. So Pat decided to train as a massage therapist and is now highly sought after because of her deep, intuitive healing body work. And she tells me she loves doing massage therapy because it brings her and her clients peace. She focuses her attention on others, and she listens deeply to their bodies, which gets her out of her own story in her head. She puts her robust strength into her massage strokes as opposed to into doing harm to herself or others. And breathing deeply while massaging and listening all day to soothing new age music, well, you can imagine it helps her feel pretty calm. Pat isn't doing massage simply to escape her difficult life. Instead, she's choosing a lifestyle, a work, that brings her peace, centeredness, purpose, and calm. Work that is of service to others, that heals and helps others, which in turn supports her to lead the kind of life she wants. So if we're proactive about where we place our attention, we're not as liable to be swept away by things we don't want, or by moods, or by sensations, or our natural genetic tendencies. In fact, there's a genetic tendency in my family towards anxiety and depression. So I have to work really hard every day to be intentional about doing things that will help me feel balanced, calm, and purposeful. As I told some of you, this summer I began a regular practice of meditating at least 30 minutes every morning. I had meditated for many years using many different techniques and adding it to my spiritual practice haphazardly, but I wasn't in a committed daily practice. And it took a conversation with Hilary Rosen, whom many of you know, to really change things for me. I observed her dealing with one difficult situation after the next, never losing her cool and always having a sense of calm. And in awe of her resilience and capacity for non-reactivity, I asked Hilary how she remains so calm and centered in the face of the many ongoing challenges in her life. And much to my surprise, she said, "Oh, that's 30 years of daily meditation. I meditate twice a day for 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening every day without fail." And Hilary credits her remarkable resilience and positive attitude in life, which I know you know, despite many difficult setbacks, to this regular long-term meditation practice. And she credits her resilience to learning how and where to focus her attention. So inspired, I began right away. And I'm proud to say that exactly today, I celebrate 90 days in a row of at least 30 minutes of meditation a day. And I even got up at 5 o'clock this morning to make sure I got my 90th day in, because my app tells me every day how many days I've done, and I don't want to disappoint it. So if you need help, an app is a great way of helping yourself become regular that way. And it's not easy every day. I won't pretend, because sometimes I really struggle when my body or my mind feels so restless. But I do notice it's making a huge difference in my day and in my life. Focusing my intention on stilling my mind and body each day, finding my inner stillness, I feel much calmer and more able to deal with the many challenging aspects of my work and of my life. Meditation allows us to practice stepping out of our habitual patterns. In a quiet space, we can let go of the mind, of the world, of our sensations and continual distractions, and make space to discover something much deeper. Now, previously, I would get up early and quickly be swept up by the clamoring demands of email and to-do lists and the news, and I would notice it taking a toll on my resilience and on my patience and compassion for the day. So now I'm committed to grounding, centering, and finding peace before I begin my day. And that peace usually travels with me much, if not all, of the day. But ironically, until now, I never viscerally understood the deeply transformative effects of a committed daily mindfulness practice. Now I actually see it as vital as breathing. I really don't want to miss it if I'm to be the kind of person I want to be. If I'm to help co-create the greater good in life with all of you. And if I'm to find balance, resilience, and sustainability. And the statistics for meditation actually show that it's life-changing for many people. Meditation improved anxiety levels 60% of the time. It can reduce the risk of being hospitalized for heart disease by 87%. Meditation relieves the symptoms of insomnia 75% of the time. And it can increase employees' productivity by 120%. Aren't you glad I'm meditating? Also, studies suggest that meditation may slow, stall, or even reverse changes that take place in the brain due to normal aging. I'm guessing a lot of us would be quite interested in that. But most importantly, choosing to meditate in the midst of this chaotic world is countercultural. It's a way of contributing to the greater good rather than adding to it, adding to the not so good. When we can bring a calm, focused, patient, and kinder presence to the world, then we're contributing to society and the planet's well-being. That is how we can support and be more mindful in our justice work as Unitarian Universalists. That is how we can perpetrate less violence in our lives and become more loving, conscious, and thoughtful. Now, I don't know about you, but that's who I want to be. And that's what this reactive, impulsive, inflamed world needs from all of us at this time. Now, I know meditation isn't for everyone. And if it doesn't work for you, I invite you to explore doing some different kind of attention practice. But look at what that might be for you. How can you practice focusing your attention on things that are meaningful to you? Because if we listen to life, if we give space in our lives between the noise and the clamor, we might even hear its deeper messages. When we can bring this kind of presence and attention into life, we change the world, one being at a time. My friends, in this age of distraction, choosing where we pay attention is vital. Pay attention to what brings you joy. Pay attention to what makes you and others feel good. Pay attention to how you grow your own peace and resilience. Pay attention to where and how you can make a difference. Pay attention to what life is calling you to do. And I'm really interested to hear your stories of where you choose to place your attention this month. So please watch this month and feel free to share with one another and me what you're choosing to place your attention on. Because it matters. It matters, especially now. I close with an admonition from Columbia Law School professor and author Tim Wu, who says, "We must act individually and collectively to make our attention our own again, and so reclaim ownership of the very experience of living." Reclaim ownership of the very experience of living. May it be so.